This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Across the country, cloud kitchens or ghost kitchens are popping up. They're driven by the rise in food delivery apps. They're kitchens for delivery-only restaurants and other concepts that don't require a physical dining room. An LA-based company run by former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick is eyeing up Orlando as a location for one of its cloud kitchens. And there are Central Florida-based companies getting in on the act too. So how are these kitchens changing the culinary landscape? Jay Nardowitz is co-founder and chief culinary officer of Ghost Kitchen Orlando. Jay, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Also joined by Mark Baratelli. He's the publisher of The Daily City, among other things. Mark, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Jessica Tantalo is the chef in residence at East End Market. Jessica, thank you as well.
Thanks.
So, Mark, I want to start with you. Ghost kitchens are kind of a new concept, at least for Orlando in some respects, right? Well, just explain what a ghost kitchen or a cloud kitchen is.
It's a place where a business can cook their food and they don't have to interact face-to-face with guests. There's no tables, there's no chairs, and it's a completely online ordering to-go establishment. Mm-hmm. So the restaurant has an identity online, and people order through ordering apps like Grubhub and Uber Eats, but they never really interact face-to-face with the business.
Mm-hmm. So, Jay, you have Ghost Kitchen Orlando on your shirt. This is your business.
It is.
Tell us about Ghost Kitchen Orlando. What's going
on
there?
So we're 4 weeks in, 4 weeks live. The first 2 weeks we started opening with lunch and catering. And this week we started live with our fresh prepared chilled meals for mm-hmm. delivery.
Okay. And so that's a whole other kind of avenue
Correct.
That people are getting food now. It's like
Correct.
People who don't have time to prepare mm-hmm. stuff themselves. So how much preparation goes into those meals?
We prep up. It takes us about 2 days, and we're doing everything fresh. The orders come in. We know exactly what to buy, what to make.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're delivering. We're doing a pilot through FedEx, which we're delivering. That's how we're getting our deliveries to our customers.
And how many customers do you have so far?
It's growing. We probably have 120, and we've got over just under 1,000 followers on Instagram. So it's slowly growing. It's getting there, and we're quite happy and proud of what's going on.
And is Instagram your prime means of getting
it's
the word out?
It's one of them. We're using Facebook, other social media.
And that's kind of interesting. Mark, I wonder what you think about that, the notion of kind of Instagram as the way to get food ideas out there, because everybody's taking photos of their food and mm-hmm. posting it online now, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're all taking photos of our own foods, sharing other photos of other people's food. Like, you're actually taking orders on Instagram, or more like promoting
sales? And we'll put promotional codes on. But what's interesting is, I mean, I'm coming from a full restaurant background, and the ghost kitchen concept, it's not like the customers are driving by, right, and seeing a restaurant being built. So it's a slower way of getting, it's a slower process of getting your name out there.
So the Instagram account is being used to create that identity,
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
right.
So great.
Jessica, what's your experience been of this style of kitchen? Because you worked in commissary kitchens, right?
Yeah, I've managed East End for about 6 years, and we have a mirage of businesses that come in.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly traditional caterers and other things, a lot of the pop-up revolution, but I have a lot of people that have been coming in recently that are asking if they could do this sort of thing because
right.
they see the trend in delivery. They see that it's going positively, and it's, you know, you don't have to deal with the rest of the operations of a restaurant, which leaves, I think it takes away a lot of the room for error,
mm-hmm.
Or at least you're marginalizing what the errors could be. So it's really attractive,
right.
especially if someone is a great cook, but they don't have a full-fledged business yet. Like if you're using Instagram to create the face of your business, you have time to curate that and put it on, and it's exactly what you want. You know, you're not necessarily dealing with maybe a hostess that is maybe in a mood or something like that. It's
mm-hmm.
I think you're more in control of the guest experience.
And so when folks come to you and say, we'd like to be able to use this kitchen and use it for delivery, what's the response? Does East End Market have that capacity or not?
We might be able to. It would depend on the time of day. I mean, everybody knows how amazing our parking situation is. So, I mean, keeping that in mind so that we're not taking away from folks that want to come and dine inside East End and experience East End for what it is. And then our kitchen is smaller than most commissaries, so I think it could be done. It would depend on your amount of orders. I mean, the overhead of renting the kitchen and just staying open, hoping an order comes in, could be fabulous, mm-hmm. or it could not be. So I think it could work for an established business. And we've had people ask, but it's nothing that we've ever implemented yet to this mm-hmm. point.
Mark, tell us about the piece that you wrote for the Daily City a week or two back about Cloud Kitchen or Cloud Kitchens. This is a new business that's sort of looking to get established in Florida, in Orlando. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I saw in city council meeting notes that a business wanted to put in less parking spaces than it was less than it was supposed to. And I read that it was a 41 kitchen operation, and that just caught my eye. And then I started researching, and I could not find the name of the company anywhere. It was the fake LLC, Virginia, this state, that state, an office building in L.A. And I finally came up with this name. It's like Bananas like some kind of banana company LLC, literally. Mm-hmm. And I ended up finding through research that it was Cloud Kitchens, which is a company that is now led by the former CEO of Uber. And it's this space they're building is going to be it costs over $1 million, and they're coming into Orlando and Jacksonville and Miami, and they target primarily spaces that are sort of underutilized mm-hmm. spaces. And they sometimes go into distressed areas, and they sometimes go into spaces. They're called opportunity zones.
Okay.
So they basically sort of through adaptive reuse turn underused buildings into these mega kitchen operations.
The photo in the story was of what looks like it used to be a storage unit or a series of storage facilities, right? I mean, we have enough of those in Orlando, probably. So it's interesting to see some of that being repurposed into something completely different.
Yeah, it's cool, and it's like just a few blocks from the football stadium, mm-hmm. so it's like centrally located. So, like, I mean, think about the delivery that's like right there, and right next to the Creative Village, right next to the thousands of apartment buildings that are under construction in the next 10 years in downtown. I mean, it's like the perfect location.
Mm-hmm. What about your location, Jay? Do you have to sort of think pretty carefully about where you're going to be if you're a delivery-based service?
Well, our location is my consulting culinary kitchen that I've had for 18 years.
Okay.
So it just worked for us. We're south of Orlando. Lunch we're doing through the third party. Catering, we're either self-delivering or using an app called Easy Caterer. And then again, the fresh prepared meals is FedEx. We can get all over Orlando. Our delivery fees actually will change, right, by the distance.
Mm-hmm. How do you factor in I-4 and what's going on there? Do you try and avoid it for delivery?
I don't think you can avoid it, and it's been it is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And so, is there like places that you just can't go because it's too far out, or how do you sort of figure that out?
No, we can go within a 40-mile radius, but again, our delivery fees get higher the further out that we're going.
Sort of thinking about the way the industry's going, does it seem like a lot of chefs are considering this kind of pivot to something that doesn't have a physical restaurant front or a place where people can come and sit down and eat?
I think for me, we started this because my son graduated Rollins with his MBA. And he actually said, what do you think about doing a ghost kitchen? So he went and did research, put a business plan together, and it was a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually setting up the company for him. So he's actually the full owner. My wife and I are partners in it. I think any restaurateur that's thinking about going into the restaurant industry or any chef, it's actually easier for a chef to do this than to do a full-blown restaurant. Your investment is minimal.
Mm-hmm.
From the restaurant side, you have very little HR issues. You don't have a bar to worry about. You don't have a full staff to worry about. It's a no-brainer.
It reminds me of 2011 when the food truck scene popped off. And I just got so excited that, like, you could get into this industry for, like you said, a much lower cost, make a name for yourself through these events, and then have a full-fledged restaurant business on wheels and a catering business. And I feel like this, I'm not a restaurant expert, but this, I think, is going to do what food trucks did, you know, for the food scene. It's going to have the same sort of impact. It's going to get a lot of people into it quicker.
Mm-hmm.
There was $10.2 billion spent on off-premise restaurant dining in 2018. And that's a lot of money.
Off-premise means delivery?
Off-premise delivery or pickup.
And is that nationwide?
That's nationwide in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And these kitchens, like, they are used for people who want to start a restaurant from square one, a delivery business. But they're also used by established restaurants. So, like, a large restaurant that already has a name, already has a brand, can rent out one of these kitchens. And then they can either establish a new brand that is delivery only or take their brand that people already know and do their delivery through the ghost kitchen. The other thing is that a food truck can also rent one of these kitchens to not only use for their services, but also to also get them into delivery as well.
Mm-hmm. So the food truck scene is still pretty strong, still pretty vibrant?
Yes. It seems like maybe to the general public that it's kind of like faded away, but it is absolutely strong. It's really gotten its claws or whatever into the scene where they're all over office parks. They're doing a ton of catering for special events. They are at the. I just did a thing last week at a hotel. The hotels pay trucks to come in, park, and then get out, and then the hotel serves food from them to give that food truck event feeling.
But it's not food that's made by the food truck?
No. The hotels, they want the money. They want the money to go to them for their food so they don't lose money. But they still want to give that food truck event feel. Like, guests are asking for this type of event.
That's interesting. And food truck owners are okay with that? I mean, they're worried about sort of diluting their brand identity or something?
No, because most of these people who are at these events at these giant hotels, they're from out of town. So they're seeing these trucks for the first time, then they leave town. So it's another way to make money.
Jessica, just kind of thinking globally about how people are eating these days, whether they're eating in more or eating out, do you think there's a new generation that are probably more likely to just order something in rather than actually take the time to go out and sit at a restaurant and eat a meal?
I think so. I think you always make time to go out to eat, but I think on a regular schedule, people are eating out more, doing takeout more.
Mm-hmm.
You're busy throughout the day. Maybe you have one or two jobs. It's easier just to send yourself something. I mean, you can order from your phone while you're at the gym and you get home from the gym and it's waiting for you, or it'll be there by the time you get out of the shower. So I think it works its way into being able to usually eat more healthful and eat fresher if you're not able to cook.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm maybe not the best to speak on it because I probably make 90% of the meals I eat because that's just a joy for me. But I know that across the board, I'm becoming more of a minority in that regard, and that people want to be able to have access to a good meal that they'd feel good about eating, that, you know, doesn't come from a drive-thru or they're not worried about what's in it. So I think it's going to be positive, and it's going to allow more people to eat more fresh food.
Are people sort of better informed about what they're eating now, do you think? Do you think, like, the kind of the explosion of food media and the ease of sharing kind of stories about food, does that make people kind of better eaters?
I think so. I mean, it's awesome when I go somewhere and people are familiar with ingredients and they're talking about it and they're like, oh, I wonder how they made this, and they can instantly cure their curiosity by just hopping online and watching a video. I mean, I think probably food videos are more watched than anything, whether you like to cook or not like to cook, even just having it on in the background. I feel like anywhere I go, there's, even if it's just Food Network, there's something on about food all of the time. And, you know, allowing people to be more adventurous and then to talk about their food while they're eating it, while they're photographing it, while they're describing it because they took a photo of it. So it's really kind of, I think, taken over, and it's an exciting thing. It's not just, you know, something you're doing for sustenance anymore.
Now, one of the things that East End Market kind of prides itself on, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like there's this sort of notion that people really want to know where their food comes from. I mean, you've got like a herb garden out front, and a lot of the vendors there are really thinking pretty carefully about their ingredients and probably expecting that their customers want that level of experience as well. How do you think the trend of cloud kitchens or more sort of food delivery where people aren't necessarily connecting with a physical location to get their food, is that going to change that experience as well?
You know, that's a great question. I think there will still be the hunger for that experience, but it's not something that people have the opportunity to do every day. So will it change for it? I guess time will tell. I think there's, you know, not, it's not every day you want to be in your sweatpants ordering in. So I think there is that drive to go out and have that experience and have that human connection and meet up with friends and be able to get a bunch of stuff and share. And I think that will always be something that people just love doing. I mean, meeting around food, it's my favorite thing. I throw dinner parties just to hang out with people. So I think that will forever stay something that we do as a society. But I think allowing people not to just have to grab something, you know, that they don't really want, I think that's what this delivery revolution is really going to be great for.
So that means less food waste in some ways?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because like Jay said, he knows exactly what orders are coming in. So he's not just prepping and hoping somebody orders, you know, which is great for that exact thing, not only for profit side, but also for the fact that he's not just going to have like, oh no, what do I do with this whole side of fish I have? Because he's not having to overproduce just in case someone walks in or doesn't walk in.
So that makes it easier for you when you go about buying your ingredients?
Extremely. And we're doing all natural. We're doing certified Angus beef. We're hand chopping. We're making our own potato chips from real potatoes, not the frozen ones that you throw in the fryer. So the ghost kitchen, it allows us to put more labor and more love into the food because we don't have to worry so much about our margins and our profits.
Is there some way to sort of track what's happening to the food? Like folks who are, for example, ordering the pre-prepared meals, do you get feedback on how many of those actually get consumed? How many might not even make it to the table for one reason or another?
Again, we just started this week with our prepared meal, so we're hoping to get some of that feedback. Mm-hmm. But we intentionally put a 3-day shelf life on it. A lot of the meal companies that are out there are putting 7 and 10 days. We have no preservative. It's all fresh, all natural. We're following HACCP. We're following FDA guidelines.
Do you think this is going to really change the way the food industry works for chefs and for people who are on the production side of things? Like, could it be that somebody goes through their entire career without even ever working in a restaurant where you've got people coming in the door and placing orders and you have some kind of interaction with customers?
It may, especially for entrepreneurs, but I still think that chefs have to do their training in actual restaurants, right? Because you need to practice that craft, that trade.
Mm-hmm.
But then they can peel off and probably go into this side of it.
Is it good having some interaction with customers, do you think?
80%, right now, 80% of our orders are being picked up.
So okay, so you're seeing the person who's going to be eating your food.
Yes, and we're welcoming in, we're seeing them.
Yeah. Mark, I'm wondering what you think about how this might change the kind of physical landscape of Orlando. I mean, aside from Ghost Kitchen, of course, you have Cloud Kitchen, which is looking to set up shop in Orlando. But does this seem like there could be a lot of companies deciding to sort of transform some of these buildings?
I think that if it goes in the pattern, did you take over a building or did you build your building?
We built our building 18 years ago.
Oh, okay. All right. So if it goes the way of this company coming in, Cloud Kitchens, they're using adaptive reuse where the footprint of the building doesn't change. And also, they told the city that they require less parking spaces than the city requires them to have because of the business model. Mm-hmm. So I don't think physically it's going to have any change if it follows the model of this. If it ends up being new construction, which is great, you know, that is also always a positive effect.
Well, Mark Baratelli is the publisher of The Daily City. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jessica Tantalo. She's chef in residence at East End Market. Jessica, thank you as well.
Thanks.
And Jay Nardowitz, co-founder and chief culinary officer of Ghost Kitchen Orlando. Jay, thank you as well.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come, a conversation with Talbot Gray. He was the first black television news person to be hired by a commercial TV station in the state of Florida. I'll talk to him about his experience as a media pioneer. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The first black television news person on a commercial TV station in Florida was Talbot Gray. Gray was hired by WESH TV in 1969, and he also went on to manage radio stations and to host a talk show on the local public television station, then WMFE, interviewing the likes of Jesse Jackson, Dick Gregory, and Daryl Dawkins. Gray now lives in North Carolina. I caught up with him by phone, and we talked about the media landscape then and now, and some of the memorable stories he covered, including a Klan rally. Talbot Gray, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you were something of a pioneer in the media business in Central Florida, not only the first black TV newsman with WESH TV back in the late 60s, but you went on to manage a number of radio stations and break some ground there. But I wonder if we could just start by talking about that first experience, I guess, breaking into the news business. How did that happen?
I was given a call by the general manager of WESH one day. His secretary called me and invited me to dinner. And I met John Haberlin in Winter Park at one of the nice restaurants over there. And we started talking. He had looked at some of the film that I had done before. And he had also been talking to the general manager up in Memphis, where I actually applied for a position with Coles Communications. I didn't know about that part until later, but he asked me if, in fact, I would join Channel 2 and do more than anything else, production, in the production department, do commercials and that sort of thing. And I accepted that position.
You started out behind the camera?
Yeah, well, basically much of it was behind the camera. You know, in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, you had we had three cameramen, three newsmen, and two sportscasters, and that was the makeup of our whole news department, as well as the news director.
Mm-hmm.
So many times, what I would do is go out and shoot on my own, shoot the story, and many times bring the story back for my newsman. Or my partner at that time was Bob Mervine, where Bob could voice it over, and we, in other words, we can make two meetings with one at one time. So when I started doing that, Haberlin came and he decided that I would go on camera because he wanted me on camera more than just behind the scenes. Mm. So I did both.
And so when you got that call from your news director saying, okay, it's time for you to be on camera rather than just shooting the pictures for the other reporters to voice over. What was that moment like?
It was more than anything else a surprise. After I brought the film back and after I brought the interview back to set it down, and instead of writing the script so that the news another news person could read it, it just said, go with what you got. So that was a surprise in itself, but later it became even bigger because there was no one else. I mentioned earlier that there was a story that when we went to shoot a drug bust, and I used to shoot drug busts, even cattle rustling, surprising. did a drug bust, and there was no one in the house. The police broke the door down. The sheriff broke the door down, went in with guns ready and everything. And when we came out, there was a young man that was saying, you know, do you know who lived in that house, Mr. Gray? And my name was known. And mm-hmm. I said, no, I really don't. He said, that guy over there does, and he'll give up if, in fact, you turn him in. That way he won't get shot, you know.
Wow. What did it feel like having that kind of responsibility on you?
You know, during that time, it was a case where we were in such a rush. And I was hoping that nobody got shot rushing into the house, rushing into the building. But when the guy came, I carried him to the sheriff's department, Lieutenant Tanner. I carried him to Lieutenant Tanner, and he gave up without any problem.
So that's like an indication of kind of how much respect you had in the community, obviously.
We had a lot of respect in the community, and we did a lot of things, you know. When we first started out, we were Well, I'm going to go back one instance. When I first came in to news and started shooting news, going into the county courthouse, being the only black there and everybody else with all the other stations, the other stations walked out.
Huh.
They didn't expect me to come to the county courthouse. The sheriff's Dave Starr at the time was the person in charge of the sheriff's department, and he kind of hinted that he didn't want me in there. The thing that brought most of the people together was that when Dave Starr kicked me out, Channel 2 stopped shooting a lot of the news stories for the sheriff's department, or news releases or things like that. That was done by Dave Walker, the news director at the time. And sure enough, eventually that, you know, the sheriff started calling me to do stories so that we could get on Channel 2.
Right. So there was some solidarity amongst your colleagues and coworkers.
It was. And later, after they walked out on me and closed the door on me and everything else, they started seeing how much value that all of us add together to work together, yes.
You covered, as we said, a lot of really interesting stories, especially at the start of your career, among them KKK rallies. What was that like? I mean, that must have been a little bit scary, I'm guessing, or at least kind of unnerving, being the reporter assigned to that.
Very, very scary situation. We went to Robert Shelton was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan at the time, and he came to town. My partner, Bob Mervine, John Wilson was the partner then, but John had some other things he had to do. Bob Mervine, which would have accepted, which would have helped that process, was busy, and we only had a small window to get an interview from Robert Shelton. They were in Leesburg having their a rally there. The news director sent me out there, told me that, you know, there will be nobody, you know, being able to do this except you. I went out and I saw the guards at the gate. The guards saw the big Channel 2 on the side of the car. And then they looked in and saw this black guy sitting there. And there was a pause. So it took me, almost an hour to get 100 feet from where I was. They stopped me. They went through the questions. They went through everything, the setup, searched the car, and everything else. So when I finally got in, I had Robert Shelton was not in anywhere I could see him. I set my camera up, and then he came in, and I explained what I was going to do. What I was going to do was interview him, hear the questions. I gave him the questions. I like to be able to ask these questions, but you will not hear my voice on the tape. There will be a young white man that you hear on the tape. And finally they agreed, and we shot it and came back. And he or someone called NBC, and that was my first film that I've done that I did on a local level that reached national. You know, they cut an excerpt out of it, and they went from there.
I'm kind of wondering what the conversation was like with your news director, though. I mean, did you have a bit of back and forth and say, look, this is probably not going to be a very safe situation for me to be out there shooting on my own?
Thing was, he just told me it was a rally. He didn't tell me what it was. There was some discussion when I got back, though, after
right.
I'd been held up and had guns pointed at me and everything else. So there was some long discussions at that point in time. My first thought was to, you know, leave the station because, I mean, I had been put in dangerous situations before, and they didn't bother me. But this one was more of a danger and an insult, I think, at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you end up working at Wish TV, and at what point did you make the transition to radio?
I worked at Wish for two and a half years, and I moved to radio basically because I think I wanted the kind of station that I brought to Central Florida. I wanted that kind of music and that kind of announcing to done.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in Memphis, Tennessee, and top jock in Memphis was a gentleman named Nat D. Williams, who also was my Sunday school teacher and my 12th grade history teacher.
Huh.
But I learned a lot from him, and the sound that I wanted to bring in, when I talked, I had to talk to Mr. Emil Corona, who was the president and owner of WORL. I talked him into changing this format because the format that he had was losing money.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked him into changing this format, and he did so, and allowed me to manage the AM side, AM station.
I want to ask you too, Talbot, about the talk show you hosted on the public television station. Tell me about that talk show. How did that get started?
Tyler Tucker was the program director at that time. Steve Steck was still the general manager. And Tyler, because of some of the stuff I was doing on television, he asked me if I could get some of the people, some of the notables in the city, as well as that came to visit the city to go on air. And I told him yes. My first interview was with Daryl Dawkins, mm-hmm. who graduated from Evans High School and later became a Philadelphia 76er. He went directly from high school to the pros, and I interviewed him first. Hmm. But also I interviewed people like Andrew Young, Ralph Abernathy, and so forth and so on. So we had a slew of guests that we had that I had access to, and I brought them over to for interviews.
You were hired as the coordinator of a broadcast skills bank. Talk to me about that. What was the sort of genesis of the Broadcast Skills Bank, and what were you trying to do with that?
The Broadcast Skills Bank was set up by Westinghouse Communications out of Washington, D.C., and with the FCC. What I did was hired a lot of people in the Central Florida market. Matter of fact, went all the way over to the coast of the Cocoa, as well as to Daytona Beach. The people that I hired, for instance, the young man that's still on TV there is a wonderful example. T. Taylor works with Channel 6, mm-hmm. but I hired him over at the athletic director for Bethune-Cookman College was an announcer at the time. I hired him also. As well as totally, I think we hired about 130 people that were going into on the air administration because minorities weren't in administration big in television at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we hired about 130 people all total to go in the industry. That's from Tampa to Daytona Beach and naturally Central Florida. Central Florida started my career there. Had a wonderful time as far as television is concerned. I am very impressed with a lot of young people that are out there now, a lot of young people that are getting their feet wet in broadcasting. I just hope that more people will make sure that what they put out there, make sure that what they say, make sure that what they do is, in fact, acceptable to everyone. Don't go off half-cock and being a maverick as far as reporting news is concerned.
Well, Talbot Gray, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Talbot Gray was the first black television news person on a commercial TV station in the state of Florida. Coming up next, Reimagining Mary Poppins, a conversation with journalist Renata Sago. Her photography exhibit at the Orlando Public Library reimagines Mary Poppins as a modern-day black woman, invoking joy and power in marginalized communities across the United States. That conversation when Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Black Mary, an homage to black feminine magic, is a photo exhibit at the Orlando Public Library from mother-daughter duo Kanika and Renata Sago. Renata is a former WMFE reporter. She's also reported for Marketplace, NPR, and The New York Times. She's reported on homelessness, unemployment, and youth incarceration. The exhibit reimagines Mary Poppins as a modern-day black woman, invoking joy and power in marginalized communities across the United States. Sago says she wanted to showcase the optimism and internal power that people have as they navigate life's obstacles. The exhibit features Central Florida residents with photos also taken in Chicago, New Orleans, Miami, and L.A. Well, Renata Sago, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. It is such a joy to be here.
So this exhibition, Black Mary, an homage to black feminine magic. It's almost wrapping up, but it's been at the Orlando Public Library for about a month now, and it features 25 photographs. It reimagines Mary Poppins, popular 1930s-era British nanny, who, of course, has had a bit of a comeback, a renaissance, I guess, with the movie coming out as a modern-day black woman invoking joy and power in marginalized communities across the United States. You've really taken a cultural icon, I guess, and sort of taken a brand new look at it.
Right. It's funny because a lot of people look at Mary Poppins and they know her from the film, or some people I've met have even read the books. But this is this sort of internationally recognized iconic character who represents joy. She represents magic. She appears out of nowhere in crisis situations. And I thought it would be cool to reimagine her in my likeness as someone who's engaging with the rest of the community, doing the same thing.
And you and your mom are part of this project.
This has been a collaborative project between myself from a photojournalistic standpoint, sort of taking a bit of a deviation from the hard news photography that we see, and incorporating these images from the hard news photography and blending this element of creativity. And that's sort of where the images of joy and my mother and her own designs come into play.
So what made you want to work with your mom on this? And was it something that you talked about a lot before undertaking this project?
It's funny because I'd actually, within the context of working as a reporter at WMFE, I met this woman who was a performer, a jazz dancer. And ironically enough, I went to see Mary Poppins Returns with her. She was fascinated by this character. It's a Great Depression era character who represented joy and magic. And her fascination with the character intrigued me. And when I saw the character on screen, I thought automatically, this reminds me of my mother, the way she dressed, the way she engaged with the world, the sort of playfulness, but also the wisdom that she brought to the mix. And I said, man, there's no better person to do this project with than my mother.
So talk to me about how you went about taking these photos, because you've taken photographs in Orlando, Miami, Chicago.
Los Angeles, New Orleans. Well, we did a bit of guerrilla photography planning. So I'm based in Orlando as a reporter, but obviously Miami's relatively close. So we started the project here in Orlando, just reporting here and seeing and talking regularly about some of the obstacles that people deal with. It was no real question not to do it. So my mom came in. The project involved road trips. It involved, hey, let's hop out of the car here. This looks like a really interesting place, or we're meeting interesting people. And it really has been an organic approach.
Do you feel like people would recognize the photographs as being of Mary Poppins without sort of seeing the, like, if somebody just saw one of the photos by itself without the context of the rest of the exhibit, would they get the cues?
That's a great question. And I think that the beauty of this is the reimagination part. Somebody might look at the images and say, whoa, this is high fashion. I've seen some people say, whoa, what is this? You know, who is this? The printers themselves, shout out to Alpha Graphics Orlando, they were saying as they were printing, wow, we thought that this was this way. And the beauty about it is you can look at it and you can gather whatever you interpret from your own perception. That's the beauty of the artistic element. And also the idea, again, of reimagining an iconic character. She's not exactly the Mary Poppins that we know from the novels or from the film. She's a modern day woman who's walking the streets. Sometimes she's in jeans, you know, sometimes she's in boots.
But always with an umbrella?
She's not always with an umbrella. But maybe, you know, we need to incorporate this. She needs an umbrella to travel wherever she goes into the world.
But maybe a modern-day Mary Poppins has some other means of getting around.
Yeah, she might drive like a Nissan Sentra. That might be her her umbrella on this earthly plane. But yeah, she definitely in some of the images carries that umbrella, or she has a bag where she's got different objects, but also metaphorical type objects. And the beauty about the exhibit are the captions too. We decidedly chose words that communicate some element of wisdom, of truth, but are also very playful.
Mm-hmm. So did you know what it was going to look like when you set out on this project, or did you sort of figure it out as you went along?
We had no idea how the project would look exactly. We did have a concept, and the beauty about the organic approach is you meet people along the way, in the same way that, honestly, being a journalist is. You go out and you find a story, you see something powerful, and you say, this is something that I want to capture. This is something that we're not hearing. This is a voice that we're not hearing or a face that we're not seeing. And one thing about this project is operating from a primarily radio journalistic perspective for the majority of my career, it allowed me to put a face, put images to these voices that we heard in some iterations, but in many iterations we hadn't, just because what story can you tell sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes a photo is the story. But a lot of it was experimental. I mean, there are some images that are not in the exhibit. I actually took hundreds of photos and sort of curated this because it is sort of elevating the voices of Black representation.
Mm-hmm.
The project transcends race, ethnicity. Some of the images are in movement. Some of them are video or could be screenshotted.
Mm-hmm.
But they're primarily photographs, intentionally one-shot photographs.
And then how did you go about figuring out, okay, these are the 25 that we want in the exhibition?
That was so hard. And working with a relative, it becomes this sort of delicate process where, hey, look, I'm photographing them and I'm approaching it from a journalistic standpoint of like, this is an issue that relates to homelessness or mental health, you know, access to programming, things like that, or lack mm-hmm. of access. And then there's the creative part where my mom's like, well, this just looks nice, you know, mm-hmm. or I'm thinking it looks nice. So it was definitely difficult to sort through the photos, and definitely to this day, if there weren't a concrete date for the exhibit, I probably still would be trying to find what photos would be best.
Mm-hmm. What happens to the exhibit once it packs up and moves on from the Orange County Public Library?
We hope to be able to create more public spaces for the work to be seen. I was joking the other day, people have said the library is a place where it's honestly a default homeless shelter in many ways, because there are just few spaces as this city develops more and more. There are few spaces for people to exist mm-hmm. in ways that they used to. So in many ways, this exhibit speaks to the visibility. We walk past people regularly. It's easy to walk past or drive past someone in need, but this exhibit mandates in some ways that you see,
mm-hmm.
you stop and see. And ironically, one of the gentlemen that I photographed, I did not know this, he was banned from the library, so he can't see his image.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is someone who has dealt with a lot of different issues. And so one of the few spaces that he's found solace and a sense of belonging, he's not allowed there for this at this moment. And so this is a reality of the people photographed. Like, these are people who, you know, wouldn't be allowed in a gallery, wouldn't be allowed in these sort of places that require money in some way.
Do you feel a little bit uncomfortable taking photos like that? I mean, is there a sort of a sense of how do I take this image and do it in a non-voyeuristic way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And everybody who's a part of this project consented to be. And quite frankly, once you empower people to be a part of something, they allow you to do a little bit more mm-hmm. than just a voyeuristic photo might allow. For example, I remember I was covering some sort of, it was a story here, and I was asking the camera people, like, you know, how do you do it? How do you get people to open up on camera? You know, me, it's easy because I have a microphone and it's less intimidating. But ironically, in some instances, especially on Skid Row in L.A., people saw the camera and they came to the camera. It's something about the visibility component. And I can't say this is for everybody, but I think some people, for some people, it just, that's how it is.
We're talking to Renata Sago about her exhibition, Black Mary, an homage to black feminine magic. It's at the Orlando Public Library through the weekend. So let me come back to the themes you're dealing with here. You're dealing with some pretty challenging things, homelessness, mental health. Is Mary Poppins in this context kind of like a superhero who can parachute in and help some folks who are in that situation?
She is, but then there are layers because the character herself, played by my mother, is someone who is a human, right, and has a backstory, and it relates in many ways to the individuals photographed. It's a backstory that incorporates joblessness or grappling with mental health traumas that that come with the turf, you know? And so it's funny, in the process of sort of reimagining this character, you think about the character herself. Well, what is Mary Poppins' backstory, you know, herself? And is Mary Poppins in some way, if we think about it, reimagined, you know?
So does she have a Mary Poppins to call on? Who's Mary Poppins? Yeah. Is Mary Poppins?
Well, you just enter this matrix of Mary Poppins. Yeah, but that gets you to thinking about these characters and also the context in which they are conceived. This character was conceived, the novels came out, they began to come out in the 30s, but Mary Poppins hails from 1910. Okay, well, she was a British nanny. Okay, well, there's this element of socioeconomic status. Okay, well, the people in this project, they are visibly not on the level of being able to afford a nanny. And so what happens when we recreate, when we turn the children that the original Mary Poppins nanny, well, they're the children of the world, the children of the universe, of society, who are in need of a nurturing figure, of an endearing figure. That's what we wanted to do here, play with that.
Do you feel like you accomplished some of those goals?
Well, one thing I will say is it's a picture, you know, like at the end of the day, it's taking a photo of a visible reality of people living in tents or living without jobs. And so these are systemic issues that a camera, you know, it's not like you take the camera and automatically a check pops out of the camera to help somebody. What the project does, hopefully, is bring visibility. Hopefully someone sees it and says, man, I drove past somebody yesterday. I didn't think about that. And also, I think what it has done, I know what it has done, is it's empowered the people in the images. I've definitely, after taking a photo, either been told, thank you. I just appreciate being seen and being heard. And to me, that is a gift.
You also had space for people to comment as well.
Yes. So the question that that I ask is, what brings you joy? And some people wrote, a walk in nature on a sunny, cool day. Friendship. Earth, friendly people, space. Seeing the smile of one you most care about, working hard. It brings me joy to be with my family and friends. So you see different things. Being independent, no matter, just have joy in your future. The laughter of a child, when people see the humanity in others. It's just awesome to breathe and to feel my son's movement in my belly makes me feel more alive and be more thankful to live. Seeing strangers walking around with a smile on their face is so nice. It's so nice because how often do we just sit and just write that down or even think about it? I mean, you could exist in the world, but the reality of visibility of seeing others is to be present, right? It's just to be present. And that's what this project is about. just be present and see people around you.
Well, Renata Sago is the photographer behind Black Mary, an homage to Black feminine magic. It's from her and her mother, Kanika, and it's on display at the Orlando Public Library through February 29th. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can check out previous shows on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.